You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Life's better with American Family Insurance because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit amfam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hi.
Hello.
This is Tanya Pinkins, and you are listening to You Can't Say That on the Broadway Podcast Network. Normally, I just talk to my friends and my colleagues so I know something about them. They've told me stories that they might have forgotten telling me, and I'm going to, you know, coax them out of them on this. But today, I'm doing something a little different. I'm speaking to a total stranger. I just met him when he walked through the door a few minutes ago. I reached out to him because I read something he wrote on HowlRound. And the title of it intrigued me. It was called Woke Supremacy. And I was like, well, who's writing this? And then when I found out it was a white male homosexual man working in the arts, I was like, let me read this. Let me see if this is for real. So I'm going to read a little quote from it. He says, woke supremacy is not, woke is not a destination, nor is it a virtue. It means awake. Yet this word has become the single greatest obstacle to staying awake to racism. White people must be careful about how proudly we wear this badge. In fact, it might be time to hang it back on the shelf.
It's provocative.
Join me in welcoming Donnie Repshar.
Hi. Hello.
Hi, Donnie.
Thank you for having me.
Now,
Tanya, is it?
It is Tanya. Was this a thesis?
Yeah.
For what?
So I just graduated from the New School's nonprofit management graduate program.
Okay.
And I was asked, the culminating assessment is to write a capstone that is really a research project of your choosing.
Okay.
And all it really has to be is a paper of publishable quality. And so I have been thinking, honestly, for the past 2 years about what this is going to be for me. And
how did you come to this?
Yeah. Over the course of the summer, I had been, it's been 2 years since I've really read for pleasure or read sort of outside of my requirements for graduate school. And so I had been collecting a stack of books that I wanted to read for me once graduate school was over.
And I'm going to stop you right there.
Yeah.
Where are you from?
I'm from Dallas, Texas.
Texas?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, you're a Southerner.
Yeah.
Okay, what does that mean? What's your, which side of the divide would you be on? Are you a conservative Texan, a liberal Texan?
I'm an ex-Texan.
An ex-Texan, you're a recovering Texan.
Recovering Texan. No, that's not true. I need to change that. I need to fix that. I need to fix my face about Texas a little bit. My husband's family lives in Houston, and
okay.
My family lives in Dallas.
Okay.
And so we're there frequently. And
okay.
And so, yeah, I think part of my adulthood needs to be reincorporating the love of Texas that I once had back into my life.
But it's got, you just said you had a husband. That doesn't sound like a Texan value.
That's what
value,
I'm saying. That's so. What, you know, it's taken me some time.
Okay, so I needed to know a little background of why
yeah.
you're thinking about wokeness. What brought you to think about wokeness?
Yeah. Well, I've, you
Is your husband black?
No, ma'am.
Okay.
Suddenly, we summon Texas and these ma'ams start popping out.
That's okay. Yeah. I'm okay to be a ma'am.
Okay,
I'm
love
old
that.
Enough to be a ma'am.
Yeah, so I, as you know, I am fully engaged in sort of the Twitter conversations and the cultural conversations about demanding justice and equality, specifically within our arts institutions. And I have had the great fortune of working for two arts institutions in the city. Over the past 5 years, Signature Theater is where I began a development career, and then I've spent the last 2 years at New York City Center.
Okay. And are we going to get you fired with this conversation?
We'll see. time will tell. I'm taking one step at a time today. No, I don't think so. I am very aware of the conversation that's happening on Twitter, and just in the sort of.
But Twitter's not reality. Like, people can say anything they want to say on Twitter. It doesn't actually move into the real world and make any difference.
You're right, but that it's it is giving people a platform. I think people are using it to speak out when they see racism. Exemplified in our institutions. I think because our institutions are taking to social media as a business decision, as to in a way to sell their tickets, I think they are engaging with what it means to be in that space. And I think recently we've seen a lot of people take them to task because they are members of this online community. And it's interesting to watch because these institutions are then sort of having to figure out, oh, well, we are going to post about our shows and we're going to like retweet when people like our shows, but we don't yet know what to do when people have issues. For instance, you know, when people experience racism at the box office or with the front of house staff, you know, people really take them to task in this way, in this space. And our institutions don't know what to do. And it's interesting to see that from the inside.
So what do you see? What do they do with it that you see?
Well, I think the issue bifurcates as soon as someone takes an institution to task. I think you have a PR problem to manage, and then you also have a systemic racist issue to manage. And those two things are separate. I think, you know, for instance, do you remember when Starbucks shut down all of its locations for
half a day? Oh, I know that was so silly.
Right. But they had a public relations issue to manage, and they did. And it was a provocative one. But when you think about it, like the Starbucks didn't solve racism that day when they took all of their employees for sensitivity training.
No.
But what they did was they quieted the sort of cultural the cultural demand towards action. And so that's what I mean about this.
But I liked the idea when Starbucks was going to put the questions on the cup and then people could have the conversation. And then people shut them down for that.
Mm.
I mean, I think that what we can learn from our current president is there's no such thing as bad publicity. Mm. You can, you know, profit off of people saying bad things about you.
It's true.
You can capture a news cycle from saying something wrong.
Yeah, that's true. But for instance, there is an arts journalist named Jose Solis, who very publicly spoke out about a particular instance, a situation that he had at the box office.
You got to tell us specifically what it was.
Yeah,
I didn't read it. I don't know. Tell us what happened to Jose.
So he arrived at the theater. I'm hoping.
Relax, Donnie. Relax.
No. This is just how I speak.
Oh, okay.
I'm very. my husband's like, do you need a drink? The answer is usually yes.
We got a lot of alcohol over there.
Oh, is that true? I gotta go back to
we
work.
We do like
that
what?
Will get me fired. I think we found it. Yeah. He experienced that the front of house staff or the box office staff were treating him differently than they were treating other members of the press. He had a particular request that there was someone coming to use his second ticket. He didn't know the name of this person, and they would not take care of his request to enter the theater and leave this ticket for this person, but they were much more accommodating to other press people who were entering who were white.
Okay.
And he talked about it on Twitter, and It took a long time for Second Stage to respond at all. This happened at Second Stage.
Right, but that could have just been a stupid box office person.
You're right, but that's what I'm saying. But I think you have a systemic issue that you have to deal with. And it takes more than posting an apology on Twitter. And I think that is what our institutions are having to deal with, is that you have to do both.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when it comes to... issues of racism, we have to confront them immediately. But the problem
not just racism, we got sexism, we got ableism, we got a lot of isms.
It's true. You brought me on to talk about racism, and so
no,
that's
who said I brought you on to talk about that.
Oh,
I didn't say that.
Well, that's what my paper. That is where my headspace has been.
Okay.
But yes, this is all intersectional, and
right.
And everything sort of reflects on other forms of marginalization and oppression.
Right.
So it is a very large conversation.
And why does it matter to you?
Yeah, because I think I am. If it's that thing about if you are not sort of. Mm-hmm. This is edited, right?
Yes, it will be edited. That's so Alan nice. Over there is going to edit it.
That's so nice. It matters to me in the way that a rising tide sort of lifts all boats.
Mm.
That if I am in a privileged position and I am aware that we are having white people who are working at arts institutions are not. It is my God.
I'm in a privileged position too, so I'm going to tell you, I am a person of great privilege.
Yeah, no, and I think when I'm seeing other decision makers within arts institutions who appear to be ill-equipped to really move towards inclusion in a way that engenders meaningful change, I think that. That is where I feel like I have the purview to step in and say, I think I see a gap, and I think it's time to address this particular gap.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Do you get the opportunity in your job to have these conversations?
Yeah, I mean... It comes in small ways because I think racism looks very differently to many people. I think when white people try to opt themselves out of it, what it is, and Robin DiAngelo speaks about this in her book White Fragility and her work at large, but she talks about how white people sort of maneuver around what it means to. Act in a racist way because it means that you have ill intent. You meant to perform an act of racism willfully to hurt someone.
Mm.
And no one knows what that looks like in their life. And especially they don't know how to identify that with themselves. And so people get really uncomfortable when you name a racist behavior that they might have performed in.
Well, I think that when I was reading your article, the way you describe that white people don't like to be viewed in a racialized way, it sort of spoke to me because I remember I was at work on a TV show and this show just had a habit of going long, just taking a very long time to do things. And I asked one of the PAs I said, when do you think I'm going to be called? They said, it'll probably be about 30 minutes. I was like, yeah, okay, after lunch. And I went to my room and did what I always do, which is get dressed so that whenever they call me, I'm ready.
Yeah.
That's what I do. But in my mind, I'm like, I got 4 hours. And then a stage manager, or what are you, assistant director, came to my room and said, I can't even remember the actual word they used, but they said, I heard that you were, you were giving so-and-so a hard time, or you were, attacking so-and-so because they told you your call was this time and you didn't want to be ready at this time. And whatever the word was that they used, I said, hold up. Mm. I said, first of all, I asked a question.
Yeah.
For you to characterize it as me attacking them for asking a question, I said, that's kind of, mm-hmm. Attacking me as a Black woman. And I said, it's inappropriate. It's an inappropriate way to characterize my asking a question. And this person was like, how dare you? You accuse me of being racist and I'm not going to have this conversation with you. And they closed the door and they went away.
Yeah.
And interestingly, on that day, the lead, the star of that show, happened to be reading, I think, Robin DiAngelo, White Fragility. And I was able to recount what had just happened to me. And she was like, oh, that's White Fragility. And I thought, good thing that they said that, because what I was certain of is that stage manager was going to go and say that I had attacked them and that that was going to reflect on me at some point. And maybe because I had a conversation with a star executive producer, it might have been mitigated. But yeah, I totally get the inability for myself to even explain to someone in a corrective way that no, you don't. That's not appropriate for you to talk to me that way.
It's true, and I blind spots are a real thing, and we don't know what we don't know. But the trouble is, frankly, we don't want to know what we don't know, and unfortunately, I think white people leave it to people of color to tell them when
to educate,
and that's also what I'm seeing within our institutions and the people that I'm talking to who also work for arts organizations. There is this increasing demand to move the needle. And to practice what we preach about diversity, equity, and inclusion, but no one knows inside the organizations, they don't know what that means actually, other than, oh, I guess we got to cast more Black people. Okay, well, let's move some names around so that they can be the top of our list, But
what about staffing more Black people?
It's true. And I write a little bit about this. It's not... Unfortunately, it's not that simple because we also refuse to take a look at the culture that we create. I think it's very easy to, when in the hiring process, to say, I just don't think this person is a culture fit. And what they really mean is that we have a predominantly white culture and that I don't foresee this person integrating into that culture well. And so it's an easy way for people to not get hired at all. Or if they do get hired, then watch them leave in a year because they don't feel like they're heard in every room. Or, that their voice matters on an equal playing field. And that...
But I think that culture issue comes up can be not even just whiteness or... I mean, culture fit for me, like shadowing as a director in television, that's such a male, white male-dominated thing. So I had to learn to fit into that culture to even be on the sets. Or even as a union, elected union person, there was a culture to that I definitely didn't fit in and didn't want to fit in and, resigned my position because... Cultures, especially ones that have been around for a long time, can get very stuck in how we do things and how we're comfortable and not wanting to disrupt our comfort.
Yeah. I would love to hear you talk more about what it means to find yourself now in the position to be creating art.
Mm-hmm.
And what your experience has been sort of establishing new cultures for the project that you may be working on? Or would you even characterize it that way?
Yeah. Well, I think what I would say is that my career was made possible first by Hal Prince and Steve Sondheim giving me my first Broadway show at 19. Mm. So that walked me into the doors of New York in a way that very few people get to do.
Yeah.
And then I got to be on a soap opera. So I was kind of, I would say I was a chocolate dipped Barbie doll. You know, I you know, walked the talk right. I had the right kind of talk and I was articulate. And, you know, black people would have said I talked white. So I was someone who was both talented and white people felt comfortable having me in their private spaces. But my opportunities to really shine and have some grit as an artist came from George C. Wolfe and Sheldon Epps, who allowed me to be more than just a chocolate dipped Barbie doll. Mm. And once you get to express all of that as an artist, it's really, for me, it's not even interesting to go back to wearing the mask and playing this thing that might get you a lot of job opportunities, but just isn't as artistically challenging and fulfilling. So one of my artist friends, I'm not going to out them, says that, you know, the business doesn't want your genius. They want you to put your genius on their stupidity. Ooh. And so I think a lot of times the people who are the geniuses don't get in the room. Mm. They don't get to be on either side of the table because genius doesn't fit into the box, and genius is going to transform the box.
Yeah.
And so it takes a genius like a Sheldon Epps or a George C. Wolfe to invite that into the room because they're not at all intimidated by the challenge. I was thinking about as I walked over here, what does intimidating mean? I think a lot of my life, I felt ashamed that I was intimidating people. And I realized intimidating is actually not something a person does. It's something the person receives. They are choosing to experience this person instead of as inspiring or encouraging or guiding as something that is somehow diminishing me. And it's part of our blame culture where we can blame you rather than looking at ourselves and saying, well, what's wrong with me? And I think that's that thing of the culture not fitting.
Yeah.
I would have to adjust all of the ways I'm comfortable for you. I'd have to change my culture in order for you to fit into our organization.
Right. And that's right. And that is the moments of fragility that happen. You get blamed and suddenly you think about that experience and you're like, oh, my truth isn't coming across in the way that other people need to receive it. So how do I sort of retrofit that?
Well, for me, I think a lot of my life was trying to be less, trying to be something else. I remember I worked at the New Group and they had been around for about 22 years then, and they had never had a person who was of color in their staff.
Wow.
Ever. And when I went there to do Rashida speaking, the process of making that play was so toxic that I myself coordinated a whole series of talkbacks and brought in the panelists, Kimberly Crenshaw and Michael Eric Dyson and James Patterson and Terry Williams. And I created this whole thing that audiences stayed for and wanted to have conversations. And to this day, people come up to me and said they had conversations across the color line that there's just no place to have them in our world. We live in segregated communities. We can't have these conversations at work because we have work to do. But we had created this space in the theater where people could ask questions from people they're not going to run into.
Yeah.
And it was very powerful and very healing. And thereafter, I guess somebody must have said there's money in this. And money was given to that organization to hire some people of color. Mm. And they hired a couple.
Yeah.
And I remember I was meeting with some of them and they were complaining about these people of color. And, you know, they're doing this and they're doing that. And I was sitting and I was listening. And I was like, hold up.
Yeah.
You all have been running this thing for 22 years and it's very casual for you. You rest and, you know, maybe you'll pick up a phone and you'll call your friend and you'll get around to it. When we go to work as black people or Asian people, we have to work hard.
Yeah.
So what you're perceiving as us bugging you because we want answers and we want to get things done is the only way we get to work. We have to work hard. We have to show that we did something every day. We have to prove ourselves every moment. And so that's pressure and annoying to you when we don't get an opportunity at all if we aren't coming and firing on all guns.
Yeah. And because it's disrupting the stasis.
Yes.
It is disrupting the comfortability. Another piece. So this essay that I wrote came together for me when I thought about four separate books in the same context. And Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility was one of them.
Mm-hmm, I've read that.
Ibram X. Kendi, X. Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist was one of them.
Haven't read that.
Brené Brown's Daring, it's part of her Daring Greatly series. It's called Dare to Lead. Mm-hmm. Was one of those, and my husband and I, we are a Brené Brown household. We have all of her entire body of work, but this is sort of taking her her shame and vulnerability research and situating it in the workplace.
Tell us what her shame and vulnerability research is, because I don't know what that is.
Yeah, so it started with she was on a TED Talk.
I think I saw that. But tell us
The Power of Vulnerability, and her work is about accepting that shame is a part of our lives, and vulnerability is sort of it is a very human thing, and we try to protect ourselves from being vulnerable and feeling shame, and we create an identity around those things instead of moving towards those things in order to actually have human connection.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's written this book called Dare to Lead, which is about what it means to actually be vulnerable at work, because, you know, we want to be professional and we always want to
know the answers
and be authoritative. And especially if you're in any position of leadership, it is about making sure that you are always moving the collective work forward. And rarely then do we ever grant space to say, I don't know, or I would love to continue exploring this thing, because, you know, we want to say I know, because we are in that position because of our professional experience, and you know, I think what was so profound to me about this book was that, coming back to your point about your experience at the New Group, is that, you know, there has to be this ability to say, wow, I think you are bringing something new to the table that I don't yet have language for. Let me see how we can collaborate, as opposed to, you know, because again, I think it's easy to lean on institutional precedent to say, well, this is what we've always done, and therefore that is the way we will proceed. But it's vulnerable to say, I don't know, or like, why don't we take a look and try to do something in a different way?
It's also vulnerable to sit with being uncomfortable, to have someone come into your space and make you very uncomfortable. And instead of moving to fix your discomfort by removing the person, to sit with just being uncomfortable and not knowing and live with that for a while until it actually moves something in you. I believe that discomfort actually has a very healing power.
Yeah.
It can move things inside of a person.
Yeah, it's true.
That was part one of my conversation with Dani Repshar, who wrote Woke Supremacy for HowlRound. Come back for part two.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.